Yeah.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin.
It's all natural.
I want to thank the Langers for opening their home for this year. It's a great schuss to be back. I think the last time we learned before Pesach. Okay. So now right before Shavuot. So what I wanted to share with you tonight is just a little bit of an insight from Megillas Rus. And to focus on what I think is an incredible part of the story. Megillas Rus, every part of the story is dramatically amazing. But I want to draw your attention to a detail that often gets a bit overlooked. So a little bit of context. So in source number one, we'll do a lot of this outside. I put a lot more on the sheet than what we're going to cover. But in number one, so the Megillah picks up over here towards the end of Perek Aleph. So remember again, brief synopsis, famine breaks out in Eretz Yisrael. Elimelech, who's one of the richest men in Beis Lechem Yehuda, which was like where all of the royalty and nobility lived, decides to relocate to Moab with his wife and his two sons. Once they're there, Mahlon and Kilion intermarry. There's a whole discussion when Rus and Orpah converted. Did they convert before they got married, after they got married? Not our topic for tonight. But the point over here is Mahlon and Kilion pass away. Elimelech passes away. And Naomi is left in Midian all by herself with her two daughters-in-law. Orpah does not accompany her mother-in-law. Rus does accompany her mother-in-law back to Eretz Yisrael. And that's where number one picks up. Vateilach noshtehem ad bo'ena beis lachem. Rus and Naomi come back to Beis Lechem. You see, when we think about Beis Lechem, so we think about Kever Rachel, right? And the truth is, so Beis Lechem today is not much of a destination spot, right? You go to Kever Rachel, you go in, and you go out. The Kever Rachel itself, we know, is surrounded by high concrete walls, but you have to imagine a little bit. Beis Lechem was one of the most beautiful cities. That's where the upper echelon of society lived. That's where Mahlon and Kilion live. That's where Boaz lives. So Naomi comes back to Beis Lechem. So the pasuk says something very interesting. Vatehom kol ha'ir aleihem. So literally translated, it means the entire city was astir. So Vatehom kol ha'ir means, and everyone kind of called out in wonderment. Vatomarna hazos Naomi. And they asked, is this Naomi? So Naomi comes back after a number of years, and she's unrecognizable. She's unrecognizable. First of all, she's totally impoverished. She's also suffered staggering life loss. She lost her husband. She lost her two sons. She lost everything. So she comes back into town, and like there's this collective gasp. Is that Naomi? So the Yerushalmi in number two is intrigued by this. So the Yerushalmi says, I don't understand. Take a look at number two. Uksib ateom kala ir aleim. The Efshar came kol karta mishabla begay Naomi. So the Yerushalmi asks an interesting question. The Yerushalmi says, I don't understand. It sounds like everybody was sitting there waiting for Naomi to come back. No one has anything better to do in Beis Lechem Yehuda. Everyone's just sitting there waiting to see who returns from the fields of Moab. Why is everyone gathered? So the Yerushalmi makes an amazing statement. Ela, ishto shel Boaz mesa. Boaz's wife had passed away. Boaz, remember again, is the ranking sage, the Gadol Hadar. His wife had just passed away, and everyone had gathered to participate in the Levaya. So do you see this incredible confluence of events? Everyone is gathered for the Levaya of Boaz's wife. They're either going to the cemetery, coming back from the cemetery, and who walks in right as they're all coming back or going to the Levaya? None other than Rus and Naomi. A dramatic scene. Now, of course, no one understands or appreciates. We, the reader, because we know how the story ends, we appreciate the drama of this incredible encounter. Boaz and Rus obviously having absolutely no idea that their destinies are so profoundly intertwined. And amazingly enough, when's the first time that they meet? I mean, it sounds a little awkward when you say it, but when's the first time that they meet? Right? At Boaz's wife's Levaya. Right? Again, they didn't actually meet. Their paths crossed. But amazingly enough, that crossing of the paths was not happenstance. That was already foreshadowed in the Hashgacha. Skip to number three. So fast forward just a bit more. Rus and Naomi resettle back into Eretz Yisrael. They're penniless. Now remember again, not only are they penniless, do they have many friends in Canaan? What would you say?
No.
Why not? Because they left. Because remember again, the reason Elimelech left was because he did not want to have to bear the responsibility of supporting the poor of Eretz Yisrael. He was one of the richest men in Eretz Yisrael. He could have helped countless people kind of stave off the effects of ravaging famine. But he didn't. He left in an effort to preserve his own wealth. As such, we could imagine people didn't have the warmest feelings towards Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion. Even though now Nabuchodonosor is a widow, we'd have to imagine, it doesn't appear that anyone is knocking on her door asking what they can do to help. So she tells her daughter-in-law, here's the deal. Vatomar Rusa Moavial Naomi, Elchana Hasada Ve'elakta B'shibolim Achar Asher Emtsachin Be'inov, Vatomar Luchibiti. So Rus says, listen, what are we going to do? We have to eat. So we know that in the Jewish agricultural society, there's a concept of tithes. There's leket, shichacha, peah. So all different halachos. Peah says you have to leave a corner of your field for the poor. Leket, shichacha, if you drop stalks or if you drop sheaves, you have to leave them there for the poor. So Rus says to Naomi, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go out and I'm going to collect charity. I'm going to get stuck. I'll take whatever gleanings in the field that I can. Now, does Rus have a particular destination where she's going? What would you say based on the pasuk? Does she have a particular place where she's going?
No.
She's just going. She has no idea. Remember, again, it's important to appreciate, as Rus is unaware of the relationship between Boaz and Naomi. Boaz is a cousin of Naomi. Rus is totally unaware of that relationship because Naomi never told anything to her. After all, again, Rus just says, I'm going to go out and collect from the fields. Where I'm going to go, I'll go to whatever field there is. She has absolutely no intended destination here. But then something amazing happens. Number four, Vatelech vatovo vatelakit basada acharea kotsrin. Vayikar mikra chelka asada leboaz esher mishpachas Elimelech. And amazingly enough, whose field does she show up in? None other than Boaz's field. So again, I want to point out, this is by total quote-unquote accident. She didn't intend to go to Boaz's field. She has no idea that originally that this is Boaz's field. She doesn't even know who Boaz is. She has no idea about this relationship, about this familial connection. But it happens to be, that's why the Lashon of the Pasuk is, Vayikar mikra chelkas asad. What does that mean? Vayikra mikra, what does that sound like? Happenstance, right? Accident, right? Accident, coincidence that she wound up there. So here, the Malbim makes an amazing observation. The Malbim in number 5 points out something incredible. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. Good, that we know. What else do we know? That if, what is the most important midah to have as a human being on the face of this earth? The most important midah? Kindness is always a good one. Patience. You have to have patience, right? People say patience is a virtue. Patience is not a virtue. Patience is an absolute necessity. Why? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. Everything works with Hashgacha, divine providence. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan often unfolds in a slower fashion, except when it doesn't. But more often than not, change takes time, things take time, everything works out. You just have to be patient, right? That's why it's interesting that in how I always find this fascinating, that it appears to me, this is a non-scientific observation, but it appears to me that more people struggle theologically today than ever before. People are having crises of emunah. I find it very striking for the simple reason like this. I remember my grandparents, Zichron Livracha, were survivors. Never once did I hear them complain about anything, or never once did I hear them question anything. It's always striking to me, people who lived through the darkest chapter of Jewish history, who, I don't know, again, I was a kid, so maybe I just didn't observe it, but I never heard anything critical. And yet you look around in our generation and people often struggle with HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a variety of different things. What's the distinction? So I think, again, a very non-scientific observation. I think the distinction is that we live in a time of instant gratification. We believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, but God, I'd like you to run it this way now. I need this now. We don't really have a lot of patience, and that's for a variety of different things. But we, because everything else in our life is immediate, so we kind of expect Hashkacha to be immediate as well. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, and he's been running the world long before us and running the world long after us. And we are a cog in the wheel of a much greater master plan that is unfolding over the millennia. So as such, things take time. Things take time. This is incredible. All right, I'll tell you one piece on this because it's incredibly important. I don't think I mentioned this in our Pesach Shir, but if I did, it'll be Chazara. If you look at the end of Halach Ma'anya, So what do we say at the end of Halach Mahanya? Hashata hacha, l'shan haba ba'arad Yisrael, bless you. This year we are here, next we'll be in Eretz Yisrael. Hashata avdi, this year we're slaves, next year in Eretz Yisrael. If you were writing that phrase, how would you write it? This year we're slaves, what would you write?
Next year we're free.
Next year we're free. Okay, you write next year?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. What do you mean next year? I don't want to wait. If I'm a slave, I don't want to wait till next year. This year I'm here. Next year I'm in Eretz Yisrael. What about tomorrow? Next week? In a month from now? And Rabbi Lau, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, has such an incredible insight. He says optimism always has to be tempered with realism. Change occurs, but change rarely occurs instantaneously. The more dramatic the change, the more time it usually takes. If you're a slave and you want to become free, that change could happen. Probably will not happen tomorrow. It is probably going to take a good amount of time. This year, I'm in exile. And remember, when we speak about Gullus, we never simply speak about the geographic reality. A person could be in Eretz Yisrael and still be in profound Gullus. A person could be standing in the Beis HaMikdash and still be in Gullus. Because ultimately, Gullus is a state of being that's internal as well. If I'm in Gullus this year, chances are, redemption is going to take a little bit of time. And this is an incredibly important idea. This is not our topic for tonight. But it's an incredibly important yisod, the need for patience. How many times people run into shalom bayis problems? And people have to realize, if you have a shalom bayis tension, just like most shalom bayis issues do not occur in an instant, but they're often the culmination of days, weeks, months, sometimes years, decades of dysfunction, they cannot be fixed overnight either. You plug this into any life challenge, your marriage, your children, your career, almost any dramatic life challenge that you face, we often want quick fixes because sometimes we're in a lot of pain. And when you're in pain, you want the fix now. But ultimately, it takes time. Hashata hacha, hashata avdi, l'shana haba b'nei chorin. Change could absolutely occur, but often it's gradual. Except when it's not. We do find instances where HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings about immediate results. There are some times where HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself actively accelerates the normal pace of events so as to bring about a certain result. Where was the first time you saw this? First time you see HaKadosh Baruch Hu accelerate the normal course of events. What would you say?
Creation.
So creation is a good one. Absolutely. So much happened in such a short amount of time. Good. What else? Oh, good, good. Actually, the truth is we find that a couple of times throughout Tanakh. Good. Where else?
Noach.
Good. I'll give
short
you...
Short
in the years in Mitzrayim. Good. The first time we see it, here's what's interesting. You're not going to... It doesn't dawn on us because it's not... doesn't look miraculous per se. The first time it happens is when Eliezer goes to find a wife for Yitzchak. Remember again in Parshas Chayisara, so Eliezer devises a test. What's the test? I'm going to ask a girl for a drink. And if she offers me a drink and agrees to water my entire flock of camels, that's the girl for Yitzchak. So if you're Eliezer, what are you prepared to do?
Wait.
Ask a lot of girls, right? You're going to be asking a lot of girls for a drink, right? Because the truth is, what he's looking for is like a mishunadika level of chesed. Like, it's abnormal chesed. No one is expected to actually do that for a stranger. That is a heightened level of Abrahamic chesed that one out of a million people have. So if you're Eliezer, you're thinking to yourself, okay, I cleared my schedule for the next couple of weeks, and I'm going to sit here by the well. And what happens? What happens?
First girl.
The Malbim there comments as well. That sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so eager for something to occur that he accelerates the normal course of events. Sarai Imenu had passed away. There was a void in Avram Avinu's life, in Yitzchak Avinu's life, and that void needed to be filled. Sarah was not coming back. So that needed to be filled. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could not wait. He could have allowed the normal progression of events. Could I have a drink? No. Could I have a drink? No. Could I have a drink? No. And then maybe the 15th girl, the 25th girl, the 105th girl, whatever it would have been, HaKadosh Baruch Hu accelerates the entire pace of events to find Rivka Imenu. Writes the Malbim in number 5. What is the statistical probability that Rus would have wandered into Boaz's field first? She's not looking for Boaz. She doesn't know who Boaz is, or even if she knows who he is, she has no idea what he represents ultimately to her. But yet, something amazing occurs. The first field that she comes upon is none other than Boaz's. Why? What is HaKadosh Baruch Hu eager to do? What is he eager for? David HaMelech. Remember, again, the union of Rus and Boaz is going to create the Davidic line, the Messianic line. HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs for the seeds of Geula to already begin to sprout. There's not time for Rus to wander to this field, to this field, to this field, to this field. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu accelerates the normal course of events, ultimately, and causes Rus to stumble upon, so to speak, the field of Boaz first. Continue on a little bit. Number six. So this to me is one of the most intriguing episodes. V'hine Boaz ba mi Beis Lechem. So appreciate the story here. So Boaz comes from Beis Lechem. Comes from whatever he's doing in Beis Lechem. Vayomer lekol shim Hashem imachem. He says to the reapers, to the guy who's working in the field, Hashem should be with you. Vayomer lo yivarecha Hashem. Vayomer Boaz lena'aro hanitzava lekol shim. Lemi hana'aro hazos. So Boaz says to one of the workers, tell me, who is that girl? Who is that girl? Vayan hanar hanitzav ala kalchim vayomer naara moavia. Naara moavia hashava imnai misde moav. And they answer him by saying, oh, she is a Moabite girl who came back from Moab. The reapers don't even know her name per se, but remember, Rus had a reputation because she was a girl who stuck with her mother-in-law, even though she had nothing. She came back from Moab and she resettles in Eretz Yisrael. What's intriguing about this exchange? It's interesting, right, that Boaz is inquiring about a young woman. About a young woman. So first of all, this is not at all a technical pshat in this at all. But I think the reason, by the way, just I'll put this out there, why this sounds so strange to us is why. Because the truth is, and this is a total commercial break for just a second, right, our conception of shiduchim has become so rigid and so unfeeling and so formal that for us the notion of two people just seeing each other and saying, who's that? Sounds to us like it's like Arias, like, you know, like Chas v'Shalom, like who could even talk about such a thing like that? But I just do want to point out that sometimes the beauty of Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu teaches us how to be normal. So men notice women, and women notice men. Obviously, Bikdusha Ubitara, his wife passed away. He wants to get remarried. And so I think just the simple pshat, ultimately, is he sees her, and he wonders who she is. She was a beautiful young woman who's gleaning in his field. There doesn't have to be anything illicit associated with it. There doesn't have to be anything innuendo associated with it. He's asking about her. But nevertheless, the Gemara, so the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, number 7, has a whole approach about this. I put it on here so you can see it on your own. We're not going to do it tonight. But if you take a look at number 8, so the Gemara is bothered by this. The Gemara does feel, V'chidarko shel Boaz lishal benara. Now, understand what's really bothering the Gemara. What's really bothering the Gemara? Is it that Boaz is inquiring about a woman? Is that what's bothering him? What's bothering the Gemara? Right, first of all, why is it important enough to mention here? Right? In other words, that like, you could skip this part of the story altogether. It's not crucial, or at least it doesn't appear to be crucial to the storyline, but the truth is, on a simpler level. Right. Correct, meaning, why her? Why is she catching? But we have to imagine Boaz was a wealthy landowner. There must have been poor people in his field all of the time. Rus is not the only, I'm sure, attractive young woman who's in his field. So what is it? Boaz asks about every attractive, Chas v'Shalom. That wouldn't be his character. But on a simple level, the Gemara saying is like this. Boaz, you are a man of stature. So it's strange that you're having this conversation with your workers. Meaning, b'manafshach. If there's an interest in this young lady, so there's a way to go about it. It's probably not casual talk with your workers. So what is going on over here? V'chidarko shel Boaz l'shel b'na'ara. Boaz, do you ask, first of all, Boaz, maybe you're going to tell me Boaz asks this about everyone who gleans in his field. Boaz likes to know who's coming to glean. Highly improbable that he's asking about everybody who gleans. So what's happening over here? So an amazing Gemara. Amar Rabbi Elazar, number 8, second line. Rabbi Elazar says, Davar Chachma Ra'aba. He saw that she collected in a unique way. She collected with wisdom. What does that mean? Shnei Shibalin Lakta, Shlosha Shibalin Eina Lakta. So, crash course on tithes for just a moment. The halacha by Leket and Shichacha is as follows. If you leave behind, if the farmer is collecting his wheat, or the worker is collecting the wheat, and they drop a stalk of wheat. If you drop one, you leave it for the poor. Drop two, you leave it for the poor. Drop three, you're permitted to go ahead and take them back. Because three is considered already more of a substantive loss, you're permitted to take it back. So you have to imagine that when you're reaping a field, I would guess, I can't speak to this personally, but I would imagine when you're reaping a field, you end up dropping a lot of stuff. So it would appear that most times, Aniyim took whatever was there. Right? And the Aniyim might not have been the poor, the poor might have not been so meticulous in only taking this and not taking this. If it was on the ground, they took it. And it's okay, because the householders were fine with that. Boaz noticed that this young woman was different. She only took what she was entitled to. She took one, she took two, but never took three. She took from the stuff that had fallen, but not from the crop that was standing. He noticed ultimately again, Davar Chachma. He saw a wisdom that this young lady did not go about things haphazardly, but she collected with Chachma. The Gemara actually goes on. The Gemara says, remember, if you were a poor person, so the way most people often would pick up the gleanings is, you'd walk into the field, you would walk to one end, pick up the stuff as you're walking direction one, and then pick up whatever else you can direction back. He saw Ruth did something different. She first walked to the far end of the field, not picking up anything. And then on her way back, that's when she collected everything. What's the logic of doing it that way? Schlep less stuff, right? You only have to schlep things one direction instead of two. And the Gemara gives another couple of examples, but the point the Gemara is making over here is, it wasn't her beauty per se, or it was the Chachma. He saw something striking about this young lady. One must imagine that in these biblical fields, it was quite the Bahala. It was a little bit Hefker, and probably a little bit Lebedig, right? All of the Aniyim, all of the paupers there, probably everybody trying to grab, because look, everybody's trying to survive. And in the midst of all of this chaos, what does he see? Order. Seder. Chachma. There's a young woman who is, every act is premeditated. Every action is thought out. I'm not going to run around grabbing everything I can, because then I have to schlep it the whole time. I'll walk to one end. That way, when I walk back, I'll collect everything in one fell swoop. One stalk, two stalks, but not three stalks. Crop that's lying on the ground, but not that standing. He saw the chachma, the wisdom, the well-thought-outedness. It's not a word, but you understand what I mean. Of Rus, and this is what struck him. So I want to show you something amazing. Pause here for just a moment, and let's skip to Rus's great-grandson, David HaMelech. David HaMelech in Sefer Tehillim writes as follows. This is number 9, Kapitel Tesvav. Mizmor leDavid, Hashem mi yagor bi ohalecha, mi yishkon bahar kodshecha. So David HaMelech says, Ribono shel olam, who could live in your tent and dwell on your mountain? So first of all, what does this mean, to dwell in the tent and to live on the mountain of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What this represents is a certain level of consistency with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If we think about this, I think we've spoken about this in a previous year. The greatest challenge we face in our ruchnius, men, women, everyone, it's the same challenge. What's the fundamental challenge in spirituality? Oh, no one here knows. Baruch Hashem. Right? So I'll tell you, the fundamental problem which is challenge of spirituality is consistency. It's consistency. The ability to be consistent. In fact, if we're honest, with most of us, the way our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu works is something like this. Ribono shel Olam, I love you more than anything in the world. You're fantastic. You're incredible. You complete me. You make my life whole. You endow me with me. But I think we should see other people. I'm not quite ready to settle down and commit. We have commitment issues with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why sometimes I'm in, sometimes I'm out, sometimes I'm inspired, sometimes I'm not inspired, sometimes I'm consistent, sometimes I'm not consistent. We all struggle with consistency in different ways. By the way, it's not unique to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The truth is, consistency is the greatest challenge in any life relationship. To always be on, to always be consistent, to always be a good parent, to always be a good spouse, greatest challenge in the world. I could do it some of the time. If I'm really good, I could do it most of the time. Most of us cannot do it all of the time. And our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is no different. So David HaMelech says, if you want to be consistent, meaning I want to live on the mountain of God, I'm living with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm living in His tent, a consistency, how do you establish for yourself a consistent religious, spiritual identity? So David HaMelech spells out a whole variety of different things. Holech Tamim, but I want to draw your attention to the second item here, Poel Tzedek. So how would you translate Poel Tzedek? Poel means what?
Work,
action, tzedek,
righteousness,
right? So, by the way, tzedek also could be translated in a variety of different ways. Tzedek could be righteousness, justice. Tzedek even could mean like tzedakah, kindness, charity. Poel tzedek. So it sounds like the Olam Melech is saying, someone who's a Baal Chesed, be a giver, be a Poel tzedek, someone who affects tzedek, and ultimately you will have a consistent relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But I want to show you something amazing. The Gemara says, what's the definition of Poel Tzedek? Poel Tzedek kigon Abba Chilkio. You want to know the example of a Poel Tzedek? Abba Chilkio. Abba Chilkio. Okay, thank you. Who is Abba Chilkio? Take a look at this story, number 11. The Aramaic is on the first page, and you'll see there's an English translation on the second page. So Abba Chilkio, I'm just going to share with you part of this Gemara. Abba Chilkio, Barbari Dichoni Ama'agel Hava. So Abba Chilkio was the grandson of Choni HaMa'agel. So we're familiar with the story of Choni HaMa'agel, Choni the circle drawer. There was a drought in Eretz Yisrael. Choni draws a circle. He says to God, I'm not coming out of the circle until you bring the rain. Don't try that at home. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings the rain. Incredible. So Abba Chilkio was the grandson of Choni HaMa'agel. And like his Zayda, he possessed an incredible koach hatil, an incredible power of prayer. And as such, whenever there was a drought in Eretz Yisrael, from the Beis Medrash, they would always send people to Abba Chilkio and his wife to daven for rain. So one time there's a drought. They send these group of rabbis to Abba Chilkio to go ahead and ask him to daven for rain. They go to his house. He's not home. Where is he? He's out in the field. So watch this Gemara. So I'm going to read to you from the Aramaic. So if you look at number 11, three lines in. Azal Beisiv al Ashkechu. So they went to his house. They couldn't find him. Azal Bedabra. So they went to the field. Ashkechu to have a karafik. They saw that he was farming. They said shalom aleichem to him, but he did not respond. Story gets stranger. When the workday was over, so he packed up his stuff. He was carrying back his farming utensils like his shovel and wood, and he also had a cloak. He put the cloak on one shoulder, and the farming utensil and the wood on a different shoulder. Kula archa lo sayim masanai. The whole trip home, he didn't put on his shoes. Kimata lemaya sayim masanai. When he got to a body of water, a stream, he put his shoes back on. Kimata lehizmi vihigi. When he got to thorn bushes, dilinhu lemane. He pulled up his tunic. Kimata lemasa. When he got to the city, nafka divisu laapei kimekashta. So his wife came out to meet him, and she was all dressed up, wearing a beautiful outfit and jewelry. When they got to his house, he asked his wife to enter first. He went in after his wife. And afterwards, the rabbis came in. So I'll give you now the rest of the story shorthand. Abba Chilkio turns to his wife. He says, we know why the rabbis are here. They want us to daven for rain. But I don't want them to know that we have the power to daven for rain. Let's excuse ourselves for a moment. They excuse themselves for a moment. They go up to the attic. They daven, the rain comes. They come back down to their rabbinic guests, and they say, what could we do for you? And they say, come on, Abba Chilkio, we know what you and your wife just did. You davened for rain, that's how the rain comes. So thank you for bringing the rain. But now we have a question for you. You are one strange guy. Can you explain all of your behaviors that we observed throughout the day? To which Abba Chilkio said, of course. Number one, when we came to visit you in the field, we said, Shalom Aleichem. And you did not go ahead and return shalom to us. So Abba Chilkio says, look at this. Abba Chilkio says, look, actually, the first line on the next page, I'm sorry. So Schir Yom Habich, Abba Chilkiah says, I am a day laborer. Va'amina lo ifkar. So Abba Chilkiah says, I'm a day laborer. I'm on the clock. And when I'm on the clock, I don't have a right to say Shalom Aleichem to you if it takes away from my employment. So first of all, it's incredible on many levels. Abba Chilkiah was a laborer. He was a manual laborer. He wasn't a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant. He was a laborer. Yet again, he was one of the Gedolei Hadar. It's quite amazing. But so meticulous was he with his employer's time that he wouldn't even return Shalom. Good. Next thing they asked him, Abba Chilkiah, why is it that when you came home after work, you put the wood and the shovel on one shoulder and the cloak on a different shoulder? You should have put the wood and the shovel on top of the cloak as a little bit of a buffer on your shoulder. To which Abba Chilkiah says, I can't. The cloak is not mine. It's borrowed. He was so poor, he didn't even own his own clothing. The cloak is not mine. I borrowed it for wearing purposes. I did not get reshus to use it as a cushion. Okay? Abba Chilkiah, the whole way you walk barefoot. And when you get to the river, that's when you put your shoes on. So it's very simple. When I'm walking on dry land, I can see exactly where I'm going. So I don't have to wear shoes. When I go into the stream, into the river, I don't know what's in the riverbed. And that's why I put on my shoes. Abba Chilkiah, when you got to the thorn bushes, you lifted up your tunic. Right? Your legs got all scratched up. What's the pshat? So Abba Chilkiah says, my legs will heal, but if the tunic gets torn, it will not be made whole again. He goes on, he says, why is it that your wife, my tama ki mata mar lamasa, nafka devisu demar ki mikashta? Why is it that when you came back home, your wife came out looking all beautiful with her clothing and her jewelry? Amar luhu, kedei shelo etein einai be'isha acheres. Abba Chilkiah says, amazing, so that I shouldn't look at any other woman. I shouldn't look at anyone else. I shouldn't have a desire for anyone else. Why is it that when we got to your house, you asked your wife to enter first? You went in afterwards and only invited us in last. Abba Chilkiah says, I don't know who you guys are. So because I don't know who you are, I don't want you going into the house after my wife. So actually the Gemara goes on. It's an incredible Gemara. I'll just say one last piece. The Gemara says, by the way, Abba Chilkiah, we noticed you and your wife went up to the attic to daven. Your wife went in one corner. You went in a different corner. We noticed that the rain clouds came from your wife's direction and not from yours. What's the pshat? To which Abba Chilkiah responds something so beautiful. He says, you know, when a poor person knocks on the door, I always give him a coin. My wife gives him a loaf of bread. What's the difference? The difference is the pauper has to take the coin and do something with it. My wife gives him something which provides instant gratification right then and there. And that's the end of the story. So let's go back now for a moment. So the Gemara says that when David HaMelech said, Who's a Paul Tzedek? Abba Chilkiah. What's the incredible part of the story? It's an incredible story. I didn't do it justice, but you can look at it inside on your own. What's incredible about the story? What would you say? What's incredible?
An explanation for every single thing he did, like he was very calculated.
Everything was a cheshbon. Nothing was haphazard. Everything was thought out. Everything was thought through. There was no such thing as an action without an explanation. David HaMelech says, who is the person who is privileged to lead a life of Kiddusha? Who is the person who is privileged to live on the mountain of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the tent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Who is that person? A Paul Tzedek. Someone who lives life with a plan. See, the great challenge that most of us face is that we live life kind of like by the seat of our pants, right? We go ahead and like, there's not really time to think too many things out because most of us have such a frenetic pace of life. There's so much happening all the time. And as a result, we often find ourselves doing things, you know, the cloud gadol in life is, and we all have days like this, you could be exceptionally busy. It doesn't mean you're getting anything done. We all know this happens all the time. I start up my day, I make my to-do list in the morning. There are 8 things that I have to accomplish today. By 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I've done one of them. So what happens? So I'm sure all of us can relate. We know what happens. This phone call took up 2 hours. Then there was this email. Then the school called. Then this one called. Then this happened. Then this. And a variety of things. Again, I wasn't spending my day playing golf. I wasn't like counting ceiling tiles. I was doing something purposeful. But did I advance my life in the way it needs to be advanced? Chances are not. You could spend a lifetime being busy and yet remain fundamentally unaccomplished. Why? Because there's no seder. There's no order. There's no kivun. There's no direction. There's no plan. The incredible nature of Abichilkia is that everything was thought out. Everything was premeditated. Everything fit into a tapestry of kavana. You know, that's the whole word of kavana. We translate kavana, like kavana and davening, kavana and mitzvos, as concentration. But the truth is, it's not what kavana really means. Kavana is a notion of kivun, a direction. When I serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu because I'm trying to advance myself and push myself in a particular direction. You know what David HaMelech is extolling? What virtue is he extolling? You need a plan in life. You see, I would tell you to do the following exercise. If you were to leave, when you leave here tonight, if somebody were to stop you and were to ask you, what's your plan? What's your plan? So I think many of us would respond, how? What's your plan? You don't have to tell me what your plan is. But in a generic sense, what's your plan?
Get through the
day. Right? Get through the day, right? Yom Tov's coming. It's a three-day Yom Tov. Right? Is this one of my plan? My plan is, right, to keep my head above water. That's my... Right. Keep my head above water. No, everybody's okay. Nobody's killing each other. The house looks okay. Right? That's my... Right? If I'm balancing my career, a million things. That's not a plan. I mean, it's a plan for now. But what's my life plan? Like, who do I want to be? What do I want to accomplish? What's the life I want to create? What type of children do I want to raise? What type of home do I want? I don't mean the furnishings. I mean, like, on a ruchni level, on an emotional level, on a spiritual level. What do I want out of life? You know, I will tell you that I spend a lot of time with people as they are dying and in their final moments. And it is shocking to see how many people leave this world in such a state of remorse and regret that they did not get to do the things they wanted to do. And I don't mean, oh, I always wanted to go to the Caribbean and I can't believe I never got there. That's not what people regret on their deathbed. They regret the much simpler, more profound things. I really wanted to accomplish this as a person. I really wanted to affect this change. I really wanted to inspire my children to do this. I wanted to change the world like this. And it's too late. You know, we always try to make people feel better. But when someone expresses that type of remorse in their final moments of life, you can hold their hand. You can tell them you did so many other great things. But you can't take away that remorse because it's real. Too many of us don't live life with a real plan. We live life with an hour-to-hour plan because a lot of times I feel like I'm surviving hour-to-hour or day-to-day, or maybe I make a week plan, a month plan. If you're really good, a three-month plan. But who has a life plan? And by the way, I want to point out, the life plan always changes. It's supposed to change. It's supposed to evolve. The life plan you have when you're 20 is very different than the life plan you have when you're 35, and very different than the life plan you have when you're 50, which is different than the life plan you have when you're 90. The life plan evolves. It doesn't have to be one life plan, but there always has to be a bigger life plan because life is more than just about what I need to accomplish today. There has to be a greater vision of life. That was Abichilkia. It begins by living in a premeditated fashion. I'm not going to act haphazardly. I'm not going to talk haphazardly. Everything should be measured. Everything should be with a kavana. Everything should be premeditated. It's a hard place to live. But that was the greatness of Abichilkia. That David HaMelech says, that's Poel Tzedek. Look at the straight etymology of the word. Poel, again, means to what? To work. To act. Tzedek means with justice, righteousness, correctness. Poel Tzedek is someone who measures his or her actions. I don't act haphazardly. I don't act reflexively. I don't act in an unpremeditated way. Whatever I do is thought out. Whatever I do is measured. Whatever I do is necessary. And when you live your moment-to-moment life like that, when you live your day-to-day life like that, then you're capable, ultimately, of having a greater life vision. Where does David HaMelech get this from? So here's the amazing part. Where does David HaMelech get this insight from? Who does it come from?
Rus.
The Alter Baba, right? It comes from Rus. Because what does Boaz notice about Rus? What does he notice about Rus? He notices her chachma. Everything is premeditated. Right? She doesn't, again, yeah, I'm assuming that what Boaz normally saw when he walked into the field was just a lot of chapping, right? Everybody grabbing whatever they could grab and get in and get out and this, that, and this one's holding it like this and it's falling out. What does he see with Rus? One, two, no, can't take that. One, here, there. He sees the chachma. He sees a woman who acts in a premeditated fashion. When you see someone who acts in a premeditated fashion, when you see someone who's a Paul Tzedek, there is greatness there. And Boaz realizes, again, I don't believe that he had aspirations to marry this young woman. There is a dramatic age difference between Boaz and Rus, and I don't believe that the Pasha Pshat and the Pasik is that he sees her and he thinks, wow, maybe she and I have a future together. I think it's something much more profound. He senses something spectacularly amazing about this woman. A midah that most human beings don't possess. The midah that David HaMelech called Poel Tzedek. The midah of Abichilkiah. The midah of premeditation. And I think this is something that we have to work on over the Yom Tov of Shavuos. You know, Shavuos is Kabbalah Satorah. Shavuos, remember again, on the Yom Tov of Shavuos, Shavuos is one of those hard Yom Tovim because there's not per se like something to anchor you in the experience of the day. Right? Pesach you have a seder, you have matzah. Sukkis, you have the sukkah. What do you have on Shavuos? You know, you would think, given the number of ads for cheesecake, that cheesecake has some type of like religious. I'm actually going to speak about milkshakes in my shir at Wit tomorrow morning. But again, that's a minhag. There's a custom like that. But the hard part about Shavuos is actually like connecting to the neshama of the yontiv. There's nothing real, or there doesn't feel to be anything real that's anchoring me. There's a very good reason for that. Do you know why? Do you know what Shavuos is all about?
You're supposed to enjoy the
gash. Hey, I'm sorry?
Isn't Shavuos the yontiv where you're supposed to enjoy the gashmias?
100%. Enjoy, first of all, every day as a Jew, you're supposed to enjoy the gashmias, right? That's part of our...
No, it's something specific about Shavuos.
Yes, absolutely. It's not just the gashmias, by the way. Take it a step back. Shavuos is a time of reflection. The whole point of Shavuos is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me this great thing called Torah. Torah, by the way, Torah represents a way of life. Torah represents a Seder HaChayim. Torah represents Halachos. Torah represents Hashkafas. Torah allows me to think bigger than myself. Torah allows me to stop being myopic and to allow me to have greater visions of grandeur for myself and for my world. The whole avoda of Shavuos is to take a step back out of reality and to think about, what do you want to be when you grow up? Who do you want to be? What kind of life do you want? What kind of family do you want? What kind of marriage do you want? What kind of relationships do you want? What kind of relationship do you want with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What kind of Jew do you want to be? What's your contribution to this world? What's your contribution to your community? What's your contribution to humanity? These are big questions that most of us don't generally have the time to really think about. But they're the yisildistic questions that we have to ask ourselves. That's what it means to be a Poel Tzedek. That's why I read Megillas Rus. Do you know why the whole shidduch, isn't this incredible? The whole shidduch between Boaz and Rus happened. Why? Because Rus was a woman of chachma. That is what caught Boaz's eye, because she was a Poel Tzedek. Had she not possessed that midah, she would have been another face in the crowd and probably would have taken no notice of her. But because she was alive, because she was a woman who lived methodically, whose actions were measured, she caught the eye of Boaz, resulted in a marriage, the birth of David HaMelech, and the Moshiach. Moshiach comes when people are like Rus. Moshiach comes when people are like Abichilkiah. Moshiach comes when people are Poel Tzedek. And that's our avod over Shavuos. So we should be Zochah Meretz Hashem over the course of the Yom Tov to really take a step back. There are no mitzvos on Shavuos, because ultimately Shavuos is a Yom Tov of just cognition, taking a step back and looking at yourself and looking at your life and asking myself, do I live methodically? Do I live methodically? Do I think before I act? Are my actions and are my words measured? Or do I just live like reflexively? Do I live just, you know, whatever the knee-jerk reaction to say or to do, or whatever everyone else is doing, that's what I'm going to do also. Or do we live a life of premeditated thought? And if we begin to live a life where we measure our actions, that puts us in the mindset to think bigger, beyond the day, beyond the week, beyond the month, beyond the year, and really give us an opportunity to think about our lives. Of Yom Tov of Shavuos, our avoda, is to really think about what we want to do with our gift of Torah, what do we want to do with our gift of life, who do we want to become, and how do we want to affect change. Stop over here. Thank you.